T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
On this edition of Profiles, Carl Skip Schumacher, who joined us in 2014 at Ballpark Village to talk about his book, Bridge of No Return, The Ordeal of the USS Pueblo. Schumacher was a sailor on the Pueblo when it was captured by North Korea in 1968. He joined us 4 years ago to discuss this on Veterans Day. And with Veterans Day just around the corner, I thought it would be appropriate to listen to this interview one more time. Mr. Schumacher died in May at the age of 75.
Welcome to Profiles. From entertainers to athletes, political leaders to entrepreneurs, Profiles gives you an insight into what has made these unique personalities who and what they are today. Now, Profiles on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Charlie Brennan on the Voice of St. Louis and back on this Veterans Day at the Budweiser Brew House in Ballpark Village in front of a great crowd here today on KMOX. Absolutely. Happy Veterans Day, everybody, and I can't think of a better program to present today, or any day for that matter, than this one, because on this day in 1968, our guest, Skip Schumacher, was held captured by the North Koreans, and he was, for 11 months of his life, taken away, along with more than 80 other Americans who were on the USS Pueblo and held as a prisoner there. And, you know, we talk about history, we all love history. This man lived it, and he's with us today to tell us about this important incident in American history, because you, Skip Schumacher, were there, operations officer of the USS Pueblo. Let's give this guy a nice round of applause, by the way, on this Veterans Day. Now, absolutely. Skip, you're a native St. Louisan. And in 1968, you were serving on the USS Pueblo. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But let me ask you, what kind of accommodations did you have in North Korea?
Well, just to sort of recap, the ship was captured after a battle on January 23rd, 1968. And we were transferred. The ship was originally taken into Wonsan, which is on the east coast of Korea. And then we were transferred by railroad to Pyongyang, which we, of course, called Ping Pong, which was the capital of North Korea. And in Pyongyang, we were held in a probably what was a garrison at a point, concrete building. The officers were held in separate rooms. There were 6 officers, and the crew were put into rooms of about 8 each. We had a total crew of 83. And for the first 3 days that we were there, the entire city of Pyongyang was under a blackout. So there were no lights outside. They thought that the U.S. was going to retaliate. They expected retaliation, as did we. That did not happen. And needless to say, none of us had anticipated that this ship was ever going to get captured. We were protected by the law of the international right of freedom of the seas. And the North Koreans had violated that when they came out, shot up the ship, and took us. And so none of our training had focused on how to survive as a POW. We were held in isolation. The initial focus was obviously on the commanding officer, Commander Pete Booker, and the torture that he went through was fairly severe, both in terms of physical beatings and what he was shown happened to alleged South Korean spies that they had captured in North Korea.
And you too were tortured. You were forced to kneel and raise your hands and they would kick you.
Oh, well, yeah, although, you know, it didn't take you very long to realize that they were going to injure you. You didn't have to injure yourself. So the idea of of kneeling and holding up your arms was nuts. You know, they'd say, hold up your arms or we're going to kick you. Well, hell, they're going to kick you anyway, so might as well put your arms down.
They also withheld food from you?
Yes, we did not eat for the first 48 hours that we were there.
And they turned off the radiator in your room or put you in a 12 by 17 room with no heat in the middle of January in Korea.
Yes, that's correct. It was pretty cold. And the focus, though, of the beatings, and this was very interesting, was that they did not beat you around the head. They had no compunction about beating you around the body, so they could kick you in the ribs, they could kick your knees, they'd kick your legs out from underneath you, they'd knock you unconscious by hitting the back of your head. But for, as it turned out, for propaganda purposes and for photographs, they didn't want to have pictures of the crew with black eyes and broken jaws. So
there was one beating of you by someone by the name of Tashi, T-A-S-H-I, which was exceptionally severe.
Well, yes, and there were several of those. And actually, in the 11 months that we were there, the beatings were really administered three ways, if you will. One was the initial period for about the first 2 weeks in our captivity, when they were beating us to get us to sign confessions and make photographs and sign documents and so forth. The second set of beatings were ones that happened during the sort of other 10 months that we were there. And those were very sporadic and generally done by the guards at night. We were under 24-hour guard. And so you'd have basically these young kids, 17, 18, 19 years old, would be standing outside your room and patrolling the halls and so forth. And, you know, they could come in and while you were sitting in your chair and just hit you with a kick into your back. You'd never really know that they were coming. And that was fairly sporadic and was done, I think, without sort of official mandate.
Yeah, this is Pete Schumacher, who was operations officer of the USS Pueblo and was captured with other Americans by the North Koreans and held for 11 months back in 1968. You wrote in a book called Bridge of No Return that you tried to end your life unsuccessfully twice.
Yes, that's correct. And because I felt that if they tortured you, they were going to get everything that we knew. And the only way out that I saw was to take your own life. And my solution, since we had access to virtually nothing, was to try to drown myself in a bucket of water. And I did try to do that twice. The first time didn't last very long, if you will, because I came out coughing and sputtering. The second time I was a little bit more determined, and that didn't work either. So there was a real period of desperation there. And actually my solution finally was just to say, which I think is something that all POWs go through, just worry about those things over which I do have some control, and don't worry about the things over which I don't have any control, and basically turn it over to your higher power, your God, whatever, and to resist any way that we could.
Yes, those are long, lonely days inside a North Korean cell. You wrote that you thought of a lot of things, like how you were afraid you'd never be able to tell your dad how much you admired him and loved him.
Hardest thing about being a POW is what it does to your families and friends. Because as a POW, you know what your condition is. You know how you're being treated. You know how you're doing physically. You know how you're doing psychologically. But your families know nothing. And to put them through that agony is really, really ate at a lot of people. That was a very, very difficult thing to do.
From our Veterans Day 2014 broadcast with F. Carl Skip Schumacher, author of Bridge of No Return, The Ordeal of the USS Pueblo. Schumacher was held captive for 11 months by the North Koreans in 1968. He passed away in May of this year. Back in a moment on KMOX.
More of Profiles coming up on KMOX. Now, back to Profiles on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Charlie Brennan on the Voice of St. Louis, and Carl Schumacher is our guest. He's a St. Louisan who was on the USS Pueblo back in 1968, and then it was captured by the North Koreans. He spent 11 months, 335 days, I think, in captivity. But not the only St. Louisan. Peter M. Langenberg was also on board.
Right.
He had an interesting story.
Yeah, Peter was also a graduate of St. Louis Country Day School. He attended Princeton University, and after 2 years, he got bored. And so he enlisted in the Navy as an enlisted man and was one of the communication technicians on board. These are the guys who work for the Naval Security Group, and was a very good sailor, as it turned out. And then after the whole Pueblo incident, he was one of the guys who was injured during the battle. And then after the Pueblo incident was over, he finished up his college, got a law degree, and works as a lawyer out in California.
Well, I guess he quit Princeton because he was bored, but the Pueblo incident ended that boredom, I'm sure. Ed Murphy went to Principia and right. High school and college, I think.
That's correct, yes.
And I think Earl Kisler had St. Louis connections.
Kisler had not much of a connection. His parents moved around. At the time of the capture, his parents did live in St. Louis. He lives out in Washington State.
Well, your vessel was conducting intelligence in international waters, not
right.
too far from North Korea, on January 23rd, 1968, correct?
That's correct. And our mission was what they call electronic intelligence, or ELINT. And the notion of ELINT is to basically sail close enough to the coast so that they will turn on their radars and radio equipment. We can then record and identify their radar, particularly where the radar is located, and then the frequencies of the radar and the frequencies of the radio communications that they use. And this kind of information is gathered up from all sources and becomes part of the electronic order of battle, so that if we ever were faced with a war against North Korea, we would know where their radars are and what radio frequencies they use, so that we could attack their command and control facilities right at the beginning.
North Korea had apparently warned Washington about ships like yours, but nobody in Washington told you.
No, that's correct. We were under the operational control of people in Japan, commander of the Naval Force of Japan. And we received no messages from our superiors back in Japan or elsewhere. Most significantly, 2 days before the Pueblo was hijacked, the North Korean staged a raid on the South Korean capital. The capital building in South Korean Seoul is referred to as the Blue House. They sent, I think it was 29 commandos over the DMZ to infiltrate South Korea and go and assassinate the president of South Korea. That effort was stopped, and I think all but two or three of the commandos were killed. And that was a significant upgrade in the level of hostilities between North and South Korea, and we had no information about that at all.
Now, the Korean warships started circling yours, and they ended up shooting at the Pueblo, but Captain Booker did not have anyone man the guns and fire back. Explain that.
Well, as a result of the USS Liberty, which was attacked by the Israelis in June of 1967, so about 6 months before the Pueblo, the Vice Chief of Naval Operations said all naval ships, regardless of their purpose, have to have guns. And so he, right before we left Japan, on the first voyage and last voyage of the Pueblo, he had two 50 caliber machine guns delivered to us. 50 caliber machine guns are nice guns. They're very powerful. However, we had only time to make a plate, if you will, on our deck rails where we could secure 50 calibers, bolt them down, and then be able to fire them. So even if we had mounted the guns, we had no protection around it, so there wasn't like a gun tub, the sort of thing you see in all the World War II movies. At the time, we were also instructed to keep the guns out of sight. We were supposed to be an unarmed trawler-like vessel. And so the guns themselves were stored below. And at the time that the North Koreans opened fire on us, Commander Bucher made the decision that to try and bring the guns up and mount them on these little rails that we had would just be suicide, that anyone trying to do that would get killed.
So what you guys ended up doing was setting fire to all the intelligence you had gathered.
Well, what we were really trying to do was stall for time, because time was our friend, and time was going to be the North Koreans' enemy. The whole attack started at about 12, the local time started about 12:30. We were probably an hour and a half outside of Wonsan. Darkness was going to come around 4:30. We had sent out all sorts of operational critical messages, you know, where it cut right through the system. Went not just to Japan and Hawaii, but back to Washington, asking for help, describing the situation. And so we felt if there was going to be any assistance sent our way from any of the forces that were in the area, we just needed to keep the ship afloat for as long as we possibly could.
But nobody responded.
Nothing, no. We heard more from the North Koreans than we ever heard from the U.S.
One of your mates died, Hodges.
Yes, Dwayne Hodges. We had we were trying to destroy as much as we could of the documents and equipment that we had on board, so we were setting various fires around, and we had used these metal waste cans to start fires pretty much on the inside of the ship, trying to protect the crew from gunfire that was particularly the torpedo boats surrounding us with their machine gun fire. So we didn't want crew out, you know, on the fantail burning things. They would have been shot. What we failed to realize, and I was really the one who did this, so I failed to realize that when the ship was modified from an AKL, which is a light cargo ship that looks like the ship that was used in Mr. Roberts, they did it by adding on a superstructure called the sod hut. And for weight purposes, the exterior of all that work that they did was aluminum. Huh. And aluminum would not stop any of those bullets. And so Dwayne Hodges and the other two crew members who were injured severely were all shot trying to burn documents.
By the way, there was a friend of yours, an astrologist by the name of Michael Luton, who before this warned you that something like this was going to happen.
Oh, Michael Luton. Michael Luton was a friend of mine from college, smart as a whip, junior Phi Beta Kappa. And he told me at a party before I joined Pueblo that he looked at me and said, something horrible is going to happen, but you're going to come out of it okay.
What do you know? Did you talk to him afterwards?
Oh, yeah. We saw him afterwards and asked about that. And he writes a, for a long time, he wrote the astrology column for Vanity Fair magazine.
Well, hey.
And I read it every month.
I bet. Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, Skip Schumacher is our guest today. He was on the USS Pueblo. It was captured by the North Koreans January of 1968. He spent the next 11 months in North Korean captivity.
More of Profiles coming up on King of OX. Now, back to Profiles on the Voice of St. Louis, King of OX.
Our guest is Skip Schumacher. In 1968, on this Veterans Day, he was held by the North Koreans, spent 11 months in captivity. He was on the USS Pueblo in 1968. Y'all know about that, and we're talking about that today at the Budweiser Brewhouse in front of a great crowd. You guys, I guess, how do I describe this on the air? You gave the middle finger salute in all your photos to the North Koreans. They didn't know what that gesture meant until later, and there was hell to pay.
Well, that's exactly right. In fact, Commander Bucher, right almost from the get-go, decided that our chief and only means of resistance was to do whatever we could to undermine their propaganda efforts. In a very real sense, that's why we were held by the North Koreans, was for propaganda purposes, so that they could gain stature within the third world nations. And so our activities were all designed in either photographs or anything that we wrote to undermine their propaganda efforts. And of course, the so-called Hawaiian good luck sign was one of our more notable ones.
There was another time, too, when there's a word in the English language that means joyous song, but it's pronounced peon. And,
yes, right.
And you wrote in one of your quote-unquote confessions, we want to peon not just the Korean People's Army, not just the people of North Korea, but the Korean People's Government, and most of all, Kim Il-sung.
Yeah, that's correct. And in fact, we picked up that same phraseology when we were finally released in December of 1968, and we were coming across the bridge of no return. They wanted Commander Bucher to record, to have the crew write and have Commander Bucher record a thank you for the great treatment that we had received from the North Koreans. And so we picked up that same line that was booming out over the loudspeakers, that we wanted to pee on the North Korean Army, pee on the North Korean Navy, and most particularly, really, pee on Premier Kim Il-sung.
Now, when they found out about the Hawaiian salute and the peon, they took away any rights and privileges you had, and then they really laid the torture on again.
Well, that's correct. And that was really the third set of beatings. I think I alluded before to two sets of beatings. The third were what we called Hell Week, and that was in December of 1968. It was after they had received a copy of Time magazine that published the photo with the Hawaiian good luck sign and sort of made a snappy little comment about how we were getting the better of our North Korean captors. And so they became very, very upset about that. And those beatings were very unrestricted. They didn't care about what they did to your face. For instance, I came out of North Korea with two black eyes and cracked ribs. One guy came out with a broken jaw. Pete Bucher came out limping because they had been kicking him in the back so severely. So it was, on the one hand, those were the most fearsome beatings that we had during the 11 months that we were there. But on the other hand, they were the beatings that really hurt the least, because we knew we were getting beaten and beaten so bad because we had really gotten them.
Hmm. You did sign these false confessions after the torture, but you did them often with such lavish, ridiculous terms that you guys kind of understood, but the North Koreans did not.
Well, sure. We had access to not only a U.S. idiomatic language, but also navalese. For instance, when they wanted us to admit that the ship had violated territorial waters, we used the phrase that ultimately penetration, however slight, is sufficient to commit the crime. Now, anyone who's ever been in the military knows that's the UNCMJ definition of rape.
So you were sneaking these little things in there that someone in the Navy would understand,
yeah,
but not the North Koreans.
The North Koreans didn't pick up on any of it, yeah.
Now, eventually, they let you go. Because of someone's work here stateside, or just what happened?
Well, the story as I got it from the State Department, it was very much the work of our State Department, was that what the North Koreans wanted right from the beginning were the same, was to have the U.S. admit to the same thing they asked us to admit to, which was that the ship had violated their territorial waters. They wanted the U.S. to apologize for that, and they wanted the U.S. to give assurances that it would never do it again. So we called that the three A's. And the U.S. was very reluctant to do that, to sign a document. And so they told the North Koreans, okay, we're prepared to sign a document that says that. The North Korean, this was in September, and the North Koreans said, okay, show us how you're going to sign it. And so they took the document and said, we're going to sign it diagonally across the middle of the document. That's not what the North Koreans wanted at all. And so the negotiation broke down. And then, as you know, 1968 was an election year. Nixon was elected in November. So the State Department said, well, let's try one more thing. And they went back to Pam and John in the negotiations, and they said essentially, Nixon hates commies. So this, what you're about to get is your last offer from LBJ. So we recommend that you take it or forget about it. And they said, what we are prepared to do is to read into the public record a statement that says we're about to sign a document with which we do not agree. We're signing it only to secure the release of the crew. Then we will sign the document down at the bottom the way you guys want it. And then after that, we will read into the record a statement that says we just signed a document and we signed it only to secure the release of the crew. And the North Koreans said, okay, we'll take that. Mm. And actually, when we were on the bus waiting to come across the bridge of no return, they handed each of us a photocopy of this signed apology by the U.S. So, in effect, what happened was, as we know later, the crew and Commander Bucher were criticized for having agreed to the 3A's, admitted to something that we didn't do, apologized for it, and gave assurance that we wouldn't do it again. And in fact, that's exactly what the United States government did.
And Bucher was almost court-martialed. He was brought to a court of inquiry by the Navy brass. You defended him. He was accused of giving up the ship without firing a single shot, but he pointed out the circumstances, how futile that would have been. You were on his side.
That's correct. Yeah. That was pretty universal on the part of the crew, and certainly on mine, that, to put it in perspective, the Pueblo had a crew of 83. We had fought for as much time as we could get, which is about an hour and 15 minutes. Every time that we tried to head out to sea, they would open fire on us again to get us to turn around and head back towards Wonsan. At the time that Bucher finally made his decision, he had 28 crew members who had been injured, three of them seriously, the other not as seriously, but certainly, shrapnel wounds and that kind of stuff. And he felt that, we checked on whether or not the ship could be scuttled. The water was not particularly deep where we were scuttling the ship. We would have immediately lost all power. So that in the event that there had been any assistance provided to us by the U.S., the ship would have been immovable. The chief concern were the naval security group people that we had on board, 29 crew members who were very conversant in all of the electronic intelligence work we did worldwide. And so that was a major concern. And, in fact, during the court of inquiry, I think some of them were saying, you should have had the whole ship just go down rather than surrendering those men.
Hmm. Well, it's easy to say from a comfortable chair in Washington, D.C., isn't it? Hang on a second. Let's come back with more questions. What happened after that? And our guest is Skip Schumacher, who on this Veterans Day back in Armistice Day then, 1968, was being held captive by the North Koreans.
More of Profiles coming up on KMOX. Now, back to Profiles on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Skip Schumacher is with us. He's on this Veterans Day talking about his experience captured by the North Koreans in 1968, and he's lived to talk about that. Thank goodness. Just got a question here during the commercials. What kind of food did you eat? And it was basically mostly turnips and brown rice, unless they thought you were going back to the States, and then they started to try and fatten you up.
Well, a little bit, but you got to realize that North Korea itself was starving, and the second place that we were housed was out in the country. The first part, was right in down some sort of a garrison right in downtown Pyongyang, and the place out in the country we could at least look out over the fields and so forth. And we're talking a primitive society that. did not have very much food, so they really didn't have much that they could share with us. And I suspect that what we were eating was pretty much what the populace in North Korea was eating.
Did you come back with psychological issues or any problems from your stay there?
Fortunately, I'd always been nuts from a, from a young age. No, we had the main physical problems we had were with vitamin deficiency because of the food that we were eating, and that showed up with six of the crew members had deterioration of their optic nerves, and many of the rest of us lost sensitivity in the your feet and legs, and so stability is an issue. We all sort of stumble around.
You were finally recognized with medals in 1989, about 21 years later. Is that about right?
Well, in 1989, the crew received the or became eligible for the POW medal. Congress had authorized a POW medal back in 1987. The Veterans Department sent all of us, all the members of the Pueblo crew, a letter and saying, hey, you're eligible for the POW medal. Fill out this form, send it in. So we filled out this form, sent them in, and the Navy said, not so fast. We don't think that you were POWs. We think that you were illegal detainees. And Commander Bucher became irate at that. And so it turns out he went to a friend of ours, one of the crew members who lived in Boston, who was in the media business, and he found a radio host, Charlie.
Hmm.
Who said, I know a congressman who can help. And he got hold of this congressman, and the congressman says, that's an outrage. I can help. I happen to be chairman of the House Appropriations Committee. And so I'll just add this on to the defense appropriation bill that the crew of the Pueblo is eligible for the POW medal. And so he did that, but not without the usual we had to have a congressional hearing, so we went up to Washington and testified and did all that kind of stuff, and then ended up with a very nice ceremony out in San Diego.
Where's the Pueblo today?
Pueblo today is still held by the North Koreans. It was shifted from the East Coast, Wonsan, around to the West Coast back in about 1999. The U.S. Navy knew about it. At that time, the administration, President Clinton, and the former Secretary of Defense, who was serving as sort of super ambassador for North Korean affairs, they felt they were on the verge of a rapprochement with North Korea, so they told the Navy to keep hands off, and the ship was transferred through international waters to the Taigon River, which then came up and it is now a part of the Museum of American Atrocities in Pyongyang.
You actually attended that museum as one of your little field trips, right?
We had attended similar museums. I don't know if we were in that particular one, but yeah. Oh, yeah.
There was a 1973 movie, I think, with Hal Holbrook starring, but it's not around anymore.
No, it's available. I'll tell you a funny story about that. I ran into Hal Holbrook one time and went over and introduced myself. We were chatting. He said, oh, yeah, he said that Pueblo thing. He said, God, believe, boy, did I get hosed on that. He said, ABC came to me and said, okay, one showing. And he said, have me do this show, tape it. Won't take any time at all. I said, what they do? They paid me $40,000 for it. He said they just sold it to BBC in London for one showing for $1 million. Do you think I got any of that? Hell no.
What do you think the message is for American history with regards to the USS Pueblo?
Well, I think I think in normal times, a normal sort of event, the Pueblo ought to be just a minor little footnote in history, but it still lingers, and I think it lingers for two reasons. One is that the Navy's official position and Washington's official position has been that they did everything right. Bucher made a mistake. And if Bucher had just done his part, everything would have been hokey-dokey. And as we know from the Court of Inquiry, when they took that position, it was the national number one news story for 9 days in a row.
And the other?
I think the other is the fact that there hasn't been closure. The ship is held by the North Koreans, still held by the North Koreans. It is still a commissioned ship in the United States Navy. We have never surrendered it. There's still a captain back in Washington somewhere who's the skipper of the Pueblo.
Those are the words of F. Carl Skip Schumacher, who, on Veterans Day in 2014, was with us at the Ballpark Village Budweiser Brewhouse. We are discussing his experience as the operations officer for the USS Pueblo, which he wrote about in his book, Bridge of No Return, The Ordeal of the USS Pueblo. Mr. Schumacher died in May of this year of cancer at the age of 75. Thank you for joining us on this edition of Profiles. My name is Charlie Brennan.
You've been listening to Profiles. If you missed any of this episode or to hear other profiles, go to KMOX.com and click On Demand.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.